Kings of Macedonia, Alexander the Great, the Hunting Darius III, Part 2. Alexander drove his men onward, again traveling through the night and only stopping at midday at a village where he learned that he was barely a day behind Darius. Discovering from the locals there was a desolate for lack of water, he pressed one of them to guide them. Men on foot were no longer able to keep up, so he dismounted 500 cavalrymen and gave their mounts to the pick of the infantry, probably mainly Hypaspists and Agarians, who were to carry their own weapons and be ready to fight as infantry if they encountered trouble. Parmenio's oldest son, Nicanor, and another officer were to take a force of infantry with a minimum equipment and follow the route taken by the enemy as best they could, while the rest came on behind. As the sun set, Alexander pressed on, allegedly covering 40 miles during the night. Horses collapsed and men dropped back, unable to keep up with their leader. Soon after dawn, they sighted Persian soldiers straggling along the main route. A handful showed fight and were cut down. The rest fled as soon as they spotted their pursuers. The chase continued, each side able to see the other, or at least the dust they made. More and more Macedonians dropped back until only 60 riders remained with Alexander, and still he pressed on. Bessius and the other leaders had hundreds of cavalrymen but no will to fight, and perhaps did not realize how few enemies were chasing them. As the Macedonian riders grew closer, the Persian nobles decided that Darius was no longer worth keeping. They abandoned all the carts along with the riches, women, and attendants in them. The captive king's servants were killed, the beasts drawing his wagon crippled, Darius stabbed repeatedly, and then they fled. The remaining pursuers were nearly spent as they overran the abandoned camp, and in no state to catch the noblemen and their cavalry escort. So at last they halted. A cavalryman searching for water came across a wagon by a spring, its team dead or dying. Inside he found Darius, bound with golden chains. Our sources vary over whether the king was already dead or lived long enough to be given a drink, and a few could not resist claiming that he survived to see Alexander and praise him. A captive Darius might have been useful, especially if he's willing to make formal submission to Alexander and accept him as the new king of Asia. On the other hand, a Darius murdered by Persian noblemen was almost as convenient, perhaps even better, since Alexander had not had to order his death. He took care to treat the corpse with respect, preparing it as best as possible to be transported to Darius's mother and the remaining family so that it received honorable burial. The Macedonian who had attacked Persia, beaten its king in battle, and hunted him to the far east of his empire soon would declare himself his avenger. Much was changing. Now there's one story that goes with this, and that is, you know, that Darius said some words to a soldier, which were then repeated to Alexander. And then Alexander wanted to capture the men who had got away. So the story goes that he gave an order that anyone who had been responsible for Darius's death needed to come forward to receive a reward, and that they would be exalted over his troops, but they would not be killed. So some of them came back, and Alexander then arrested them and had them impaled. And they said, "But you promised that you wouldn't kill us." He said, "No, I promised you that I wouldn't kill you here, and I would exalt you above my troops. So I'm going to stick you on a spear, and we're going to exalt you as high as over my troops so they can see that only a king has the right to kill a king." So there are various versions of that go around. Now, let's go back to what's going on. We have Darius taken back to Persepolis. Persepolis lay in ruins. Darius was dead, and Alexander and his army had overrun the greater part of the Persian Empire. Far more territory than even the most optimistic Panhellenists had ever predicted. Everything suggested that the war of revenge was over. Not the least, the column of Greek allies already partway along the 3 to 4 month journey back to the coast of Asia Minor. Weary, farther from home than they had ever been before, laden with plunder and heady with victory, it was natural for Macedonians and other troops alike to conclude the great expedition was over. Philip had fought campaign after campaign, so his troops came to expect to fight most years and be away for months, sometimes over the winter. Under his son, the intensity of operations increased further. This was all a major change for the hoplite ideal of brief campaigns, but it had not severed their ties with life away from the army, and they frequently had the chance to return home to see families and farms. For all their training and discipline, the Macedonians were not yet fully professional soldiers. in the sense that the army was their only life. They fought because they were Macedonians, horse or foot companions of the king. They received pay and other rewards, including land, as their share of victories. The rewards were a great incentive, but at heart they served because it was the duty of a Macedonian to fight for the kingdom. Ecbatana lay some 2,000 miles from Pella, and Alexander and his men had marched and ridden far more than the distance since leaving Asia in 334 BCE. They had fought 3 major battles, several prolonged and difficult sieges, and many more skirmishes and stormings. A lot of them had taken wounds in the process, some had died from sickness or the sword, but that was all part of the duty to serve their king. Reinforcements brought news, and some wrote and received letters, but even the young men given special leave in the winter of 34-33 BCE had not seen home for more than 3 years. Feeling that the war was won and their task complete, homesickness grew, which was not to say that after a break they didn't expect their king to lead them on campaign once again, wherever it might be. Rumors spread, as rumors always will in any large group, and especially an army, that Alexander agreed and would soon give the order to return home. Men started to prepare for the journey, sorting their plunder so that it would be easier to transport. The strength of feeling amongst his men may have surprised Alexander, and Curtius claims he wept with frustration at the envy of the gods, who threatened to stop him before he had completed his conquests. However, his officers assured him of their own enthusiasm for fresh victories and went to talk to the troops before Alexander addressed a parade of the entire army, or at least representatives who could then convey his words to the rest. His message was simple, logical, and contained just enough truth to help persuade them, for he told them that the victory was not yet complete. The Persians were beaten for the moment, but if the Macedonians marched home, then nothing would prevent the enemy from rebuilding his strength, especially while leaders like Bessius were at large. One day in the not-too-distant future, a Persian army might once again invade Greece if they did not finish the job now. A stronger argument for the men serving on what was ostensibly a vengeance for the wrongs committed a century and a half ago than it may be to us. Alexander told them that it would only take a little more effort and then they would be done. The men were persuaded and pressed on with added eagerness to end the war, although if Curtius's claim that the king spoke in terms of days rather than months is true, they were being greatly misled. So now we'll get into the section where we really don't have a lot of normal coverage. If you're in one of my classes and we're teaching Alexander, now we'll do a little show of the map of where Bucephalus dies and all those other reaches until we get to India. And then we have the battle with Porus at the Hydaspes River and then the famous return to Babylon. But this time we're going to get a chance to go into all the little details of the rest of Alexander's campaign. Now the sources for this, The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond, In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. Some additional sources for the sections on Alexander rules would include, of course, Arians, The Campaigns of Alexander, In the Footsteps of Alexander the Great by Michael Wood, The Wars of Alexander the Great by Haeckel, and The Story of Alexander's Empire by Mahaffey. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.